This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian. The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. After near wipeout in May, the Lib Dems have begun their fight back under Tim Farron. So what is the role of the new fourth party of British politics? Lord Ashcroft goes the whole hog with his lurid new biography of David Cameron, but has any of the muck stuck to the Prime Minister? And as George Osborne tours China, offering up bits of British infrastructure for sale, is he taking a gamble with British security? Joining me for all of this, we have Stephen Tall, who's a Lib Dem blogger, activist and political commentator. Alongside him, Hugh Muir, who's a Guardian columnist. And down the line, our political sage and friend, Michael White. Welcome to you all. Well, with Parliament in recess to allow the 8 Liberal Democrat MPs to attend their party conference, I headed off to the seaside this week, wondering what kind of shape the party would be in. It came close to oblivion in May as it lost 49 seats, but with a new leader and thousands of new members, the delegates in Bournemouth were putting on a curiously brave face.
Fantastic. And so many new members here as well, to be honest. I mean, we were here last year and it was a little bit depressing, we're in Glasgow, rather. And today it's fantastic. There's a great vibe everywhere and everyone's really keen to get going, even though we've only got 8 MPs.
I take it you're a regular voting member.
Oh, very much so. I've been coming ever since 1972.
I mean, the mood seems weirdly upbeat, does it not?
Very upbeat. And it's the largest conference we've ever had, Liberal or Lib Dem.
I caught up again with Norman Lamb, who we last spoke to in the summer on this programme when he was running for the party's leadership. He wasn't successful in that, but I was asking him this time whether Labour's choice of Jeremy Corbyn was going to open up the centre ground for his party.
Well, I think there's a sort of gaping chasm that's opened up between Jeremy Corbyn and David Cameron. I think there can be little doubt about that. But what I think we have to absolutely avoid is a sort of wishy-washy centrist position that's sort of a little bit less of the Tories and a little bit less of Labour and a sort of compromise in the middle. That inspires no one at all. So what I was calling for, and it's, you know, it's sometimes difficult to mark where radical liberalism stands on the left-right spectrum, but I want us to be clear and distinctive and to stand for something. And it must be about, you know, core liberal values, about, you know, power to people, taking power away from unaccountable institutions, either public or private, being on the side of consumers against banks and power companies, absolutely, but also on the side of users of the health service against sometimes institutions that completely fail to listen to people. I came across that constantly with dealing with learning disability and severe mental health, where people just end up with this sense of being totally powerless. We should be on the side of giving power to people. It's a fundamental liberal principle for me. But we must also, I think, take on some of the big issues like reform of our antiquated drug laws. You know, if we're to convince particularly younger voters that we're in any way relevant, we've got to be clear and liberal.
Well, if the Lib Dems are to return as a national force in Britain, they will have to retake ground lost in Scotland. I asked the party's one and only MP north of the border, Orkney and Shetland's Alistair Carmichael, how they plan to do it.
Well, of course, the challenges in Scotland are different because we have a different dimension to our politics, which is the focus on the constitution, and that is nothing new. It's no great surprise. In many ways, it's a different challenge because it does then take attention away from the bread and butter issues. The fact that our education system has enormous challenges, our health service is heading towards a crisis point. Policing in Scotland, as a result of the policy decisions that were taken by the SNP and the creation of a single police force and how they have managed that, is now in serious difficulty. We still have to be relevant, though, to the constitutional debate. And I think the distinctive positioning that we can have is something which is well understood and actually broadly supported in Scotland, and that is a constitutional solution not just for Scotland but for the whole of the United Kingdom. We've seen the benefits of devolution for Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. What we now need is to take these benefits to the different parts of England, and in that way you finish the job of constitutional reform, you get a federal United Kingdom. That's the only answer now to independence.
Is there more scope for Scottish Liberal Democrats to work closely with the Labour Party and maybe even the Conservative Party than there would be in England?
Well, look, I'll work with Liberals wherever you find them. And let's not kid ourselves, though, that either the Labour or the Conservative parties are Liberal parties. The Scottish National Party, which is highly centralising and disregarding of people's individual liberties and freedoms, is certainly not a Liberal party. So, yes, where there is a common interest, I will work with people where I can do, but I think the priority for the party has got to be the re-establishment in the mind of the voters, our own distinctive political priorities and political values that motivate and shape our policies.
Alistair Carmichael there. Stephen, spirits were, as we heard there, really strangely upbeat. And I wonder, is this a party that's, despite Nick Clegg's best efforts, a bit more comfortable in opposition?
Probably yes. I mean, there is something always about conferences where it's, you know, your once a year reunion with your old mates who you don't get otherwise the chance to catch up with. So there's always that sense of, you know, hail fellow, well met kind of bonhomie that goes around. But I think this time it did make a difference in that we mattered less. And so there was that sense of comfort zone. You know, people commented that it felt like there were much more members around. You know, there were 1,000 plus members there. There were fewer lobbyists, fewer corporate hangers-on. Much less media.
There were about twice as many people, weren't there, in the big votes in
exactly,
the hall.
Exactly. So it felt much more like this is the Liberal Democrat conference that we remember of old, of before we were actually in government. So there was that sense. I guess also we avoided the internecine civil war after the election because it was such a resounding defeat and because we lost as badly to the Conservatives as we lost badly to Labour. Mm. We've avoided that sense of turning in on ourselves and having the coalition blame game. I mean, you will have lots of debate about that still within the party, but there is that sense of, okay, well, whatever went on over the last 5 years, we've got to try and pick ourselves up, dust ourselves down and fight back now. That plus the new members, I think, has meant that, you know, there is this sense of vim and vigour and people wanting to get back into it. And of course, the new members haven't got the experience of having had to, you know, fight for 4 decades to get up to 57 MPs and then get knocked back down again. So they're kind of up for the fight in a way that perhaps the embittered old timers who have gone through it all before and now feel a sense of grudging depreciation of Nick Clegg are much more kind of inclined to bash the coalition, whereas in fact the Lib Dem membership now is much more moderate probably than it's been for a long time.
Hugh, there's this weirdly upbeat mood and a new leader who's by inclination and instinct a rather cheerful chap too, Tim Farron. But I wonder even of the audience of the Guardian Politics podcast how many people will have heard that speech, with UKIP making more noise in the country and the SNP making much more in Parliament now. What do they have to do to cut through?
Well, it was really unfortunate, wasn't it, what with the Piggate story, of which we will speak later, kind of overshadowing a lot of the coverage that they would have had. But I think in a way there was a more straightforward task for the Liberal Democrats, because this week Jeremy Corbyn will be asked to speak not just to the party but also to the electorate beyond, because he purports to be assembling an alternative government. In a way, Tim Farron didn't really have to do that. It was more a rallying of the troops. It was more a gathering of morale. It was more a kind of a restatement of principles. Didn't really even have to come up with the detail. I think it's going to be very difficult for him to come up with the detail until he has a sense of where Labour are going to be and where the Tories, what the Tories are going to do. Because you know, if you're going to stake out the kind of the hard centre, then you're going to have to know where it's going to be. And at the moment, I don't think that all the tectonic plates are where they need to be for him to make that judgment. But I think he did really well in terms of those limited objectives. I think Liberal Democrats came away feeling a lot better about themselves and about what they've got to do. Probably a lot more confident about him, because I think he did human very well in that kind of Corbyn-esque sort of way. You know, I think those speeches have got to change. They're not tablets of stone anymore, and I think that people do expect human. And so he kind of was doing a virtually centrist Corbyn, and that really worked really well.
That's interesting. So you've sort of maybe you've got this idea of Cameron being the last salesman standing potentially.
I don't think that's going to fly anymore. I think that's how things have changed. I don't think that kind of doorstep salesman approach to talking to people about politics is going to work as well anymore.
Mike, there's some a bit of a kind of Lib Dem started rumour, wasn't there, about defections from the Labour Party? I find it a bit hard to understand this, not least because many of the people who are most unhappy about Jeremy Corbyn within the Labour Party are really very illiberal when it comes to civil liberties, aren't they?
Well, Tim Farron floated it, I think, in the weekend, perhaps in The Guardian, also on the airwaves, and then he sort of backed off it, I think, and various party bigwigs I spoke to said it isn't going to happen, it's daft talk. They're trying to work out how they can kind of maximise the sort of anti-Tory vote in this country. Well, many people have tried that, including Paddy Ashton and Joe Grimmon, but people came to me and said, look, I would have won my seat but for the fact that the Greens, Labour and the Lib Dems are all saying the same as me, took some of my votes and let the Tory in. You can all see it. We see what happened. The, vote Lib Dem and get Nicola Sturgeon was very potent. A lot of people complained down there about it. I mean, I share my colleagues' puzzlement about the euphoria. I was in Bournemouth all week and they were almost as nice as the weather was most days. And they were like that at the height of the difficulties during the coalition. I mean, I expect the party conference to give much more trouble during Clegg's 5 years as Deputy Prime Minister. They went along with the project, so they can hardly complain now. I mean, I would say there is a kind of intellectual underpinning to their optimism, which says basically people who voted for all those rubbish Tory candidates who didn't expect to get elected are having buyer's remorse. They're certainly having buyer's remorse about having an unfettered Conservative majority government. In 5 years' time, somebody said to me, smart, articulate young person of the kind we've been talking about, said, they'll realise after 5 years just what a good job we did between 2010 and 2015. Come back, Lib Dems.
Just quickly, it's worth saying that the defection story was a bit of a mess because, as you know, Tim Farron did an interview with the Evening Standard. That's where it first came out. Then was going to write a piece for us and didn't have that in there. And we said, well, we went back to Parton and said, well, hang on a minute. He said this to the Evening Standard. Why didn't he say it to us? And I think he wasn't supposed to say it to the Evening Standard, and so they were kind of trying to recover their position from the outset. So this is a kind of fiasco he will be involved in because it's the kind of the yin and yang of politics. But
to be fair, I think what he said was that he'd been a kind of agony aunt to some Labour MPs over the weekend who were distressed at what was happening to their party. I don't think he actually ever mentioned the defection word, but it was obviously picked up by the papers.
You can't think aloud to Evening Standard journalists. Yeah. You know it's going to come out.
Give him time. He had a decent speech. He had quite a good week. It's his first time. Give the boy a chance.
Do you know the bit I liked the best of him? He was on another radio program, a rival. We shan't name it. And he was introduced to the lead singer of Prefab Sprout, which is a favourite band of his. And they said, "And we've got her on the other line." And he said, "Oh man." And I thought that was so authentic. Oh, that's sweet. You couldn't have made that up.
Stephen. Beyond the personalities, the kind of electoral topography, if we can call it that, the basic theory behind this, oh, there's going to be defections, it's all going to be right, is that there is now an empty centre ground, a right-wing Conservative government doing what it likes, Jeremy Corbyn doing what he likes, and a big space in the middle. But I do wonder about this. I mean, you can see the logic of that, but is it just the political parties that have abandoned the centre ground, or do you think maybe the voters have as well? Something about all the miserable choices governments are facing at the moment in terms of cuts and tax rises and everything means that people are vacating, the voters are vacating the centre ground.
No, I don't think that's true, actually. I mean, I think if you ask most voters what they want, they'll want an economy that's ticking along okay and public services that aren't collapsing. And those are two fairly basic wants. As it happens, on those issues, the Lib Dems are, they hate it when they're called centrist, but we are actually quite a centrist party because we believe in a free, fair, regulated market working, and we believe that protects workers and that doesn't give in to trade unions. And equally, we believe in public services that are run well, and we're fairly neutral on whether that's public or privately provided, as long as it's properly overseen by government. So on the two big issues that matter to the voters, who are generally in the centre ground, the Lib Dems are actually quite centrist. I guess the opportunity comes of we've been able to prove over 5 years that we can provide ministers that are competent, that we can be part of a government which presides over a growing economy, whether by design or by default. But it does create that open space, I guess. I mean, it's clarified it from Tim Farron's point of view. As you say, he was seen as a lefty candidate within the party. I think that's oversimplistic, but it's how he was seen. Mm. The fact that Corbyn has come along rather than Andy Burnham or Yvette Cooper means that you can't out Corbyn. No. Corbyn. So it does inevitably place the Lib Dems in that centre ground. The risk is, of course, whether or not George Osborne manages to occupy that centre ground. Now, obviously, in Guardian Towers, the idea of George Osborne being centrist won't go down well. But if he is able, through things like the National Living Wage, obviously not a national living wage, but he's able to portray it that way. If he's able to create that narrative that actually the Tories are the centre-right party that you can trust with the economy and with your public services, that's the real risk, is that you now have a massively split left progressive liberal vote, but split between Labour, Greens and Lib Dems, and with the Tories occupying that centre-right ground. And it's very hard to know how progressives will get back into power whilst that's the case, and certainly whilst Corbyn is leader of the Labour Party.
Well, that's going to be the story for the next year, I'm sure. For the next week, we'll be heading off to Brighton to follow the goings on at Labour.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you've got many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
Now, when David Cameron declined to give the top government job to the billionaire Michael Ashcroft that Michael Ashcroft thought he was due, he must have known that trouble was brewing. This week, he was able to read selected extracts of Call Me Dave, Ashcroft's virtually self-published biographical hatchet job. Hugh, some of these stories seem to be barely more than rumour. Is it all hogwash?
Well, apart from the main allegation, the details of which everyone will know by now, a lot of it's kind of very thin stuff. But what it does tell you again is something about the state of Conservative politics and their reliance on these huge donors, and the fact that, you know, there is no such thing as a free lunch, even if Lord Ashcroft was the one paying, because eventually he'll want something for his money. It's completely unedifying. It reminds me of that old baseball saying, when two teams provide a wretched spectacle, that, you know, it's a shame they can't both lose. Because you've got you're reinforcing this idea of Tory arrogance and privilege in a lot of the stories that you read from the book. It's been serialised in the Daily Mail thus far. But also the idea that they have a party bankrolled by this reckless, vindictive guy who's just got as much money as he can to wreak as much havoc as he can through, as you say, his own publishing firm. He's got his own websites. And so in some ways it was a really silly story, but there are serious repercussions from it, I think.
Mike, does no one give a damn about the kind of drugs stuff? I mean, it's not clear how far it's meant to be Cameron directly, but it is strange that people can get caught with a small amount of cocaine and in theory go to prison for many years just for possession of that.
Hang on, Tom. Hugh used the word thin. The stuff about the cocaine was thin indeed. They just said, they described a very vividly a sort of posh, vulgar, rich people's party in Oxfordshire, full of, you know, black Range Rovers and all that stuff. And they, the sort of place where, you know, there was a smell of hashish, well, there often is, of dope one way or another. But Cameron has always denied hard drugs. And James Dellingpole, a thoroughly unsavory fellow who blogs in a rival organ, as a mate of his, either at school or at Oxford, said he didn't do that stuff. He wouldn't stand that up. He just smoked a few spliffs. Well, you know, Bill Clinton did too, and he's still not in jail. Got to be careful with that. I think, as Hugh said, it didn't tell us anything much we didn't know. It just gave us a bit of detail. For me, the overwhelming thing
was twofold. One is this strange, bizarre man, Ashcroft. God, what if he put his money and his brains, he's very clever, behind UKIP? Now, that would scare me. Getting his revenge, Jacobean revenge tragedy. Wow, doing this, Europe is in crisis. Refugees, the Eurozone, Volkswagen. And we're hearing about Dave and his organ and a pig. You know, it's not very impressive. Nobody comes out of this well. And the other thing which stuck with me was this phrase, which I don't think I'd heard before, essay crisis, that Cameron and Osborne sort of make it up as they go along. God, I've got to deliver my essay on government policy in the morning. What can we do? And I felt that very strongly during the Scottish referendum crisis, yeah, which they talk about in detail. Cameron really lost his bottle. He never loses his nerve. He deserved to lose his nerve on that one. I'm glad he did, because he nearly broke up the country.
So from Mike's point of view, Stephen, the not only the pig, but probably the drugs as well is kind of real tittle-tattle with nothing in it. But do you see much to be concerned about in terms of who knew what when about Ashcroft's tax status?
I mean, there probably is. The trouble is it's about 5 years after anyone cared. And, you know, whether or not Cameron knew in 2009 or 2010 what Ashcroft's non-dom status is, I mean, yes, I suppose we should care. But in reality, how many people can be bothered to go back and rewind their lives 5 years,
yep, trying
to work out what they should be outraged by? So, you know, he's been Prime Minister for 5 years, and a lot of the stuff that is being talked about in terms of the drugs and so on has been priced in. People knew from when he ran for the leadership first time that he probably dabbled as a student and maybe a bit beyond as well. So no one really cared. There is obviously an hypocrisy point that he is presiding over a government that still jails people for drugs offences. But again, that is still, it's just priced into it. So, I mean, you know, apart from the smutty fun of pig-related puns and the single entendres that dominated Twitter, which was all good fun.
Which we should not underestimate, actually. It's been a good week for that.
But I think people overestimate it as well. And, I even saw quite sane Labour people on Twitter say, oh, I'm not sure Cameron can ever recover from this. And it's just, I'm sorry that that just gets towards that Twitter echo chamber of actually at the end of the week, after day 3, 4, 5 of this these revelations, you kind of go, was that it? Was that the most explosive thing from this Cameron biography? The people who come out badly from this, I'm afraid, are Michael Ashcroft, who thought he could buy his way into the House of Lords, and Isabel Oakeshott, who has published something that she couldn't verify independently. And it's just, I don't think Cameron is any the worse for it, to be honest. I mean,
in a way, doesn't it just justify the idea not to give him make Ashcroft a senior minister? Because
one of the things you want...
But he's still offered him a job, though.
You want political judgment, don't you? And surely in politics, you don't attack until you know you're going to win.
Yeah, it's interesting because he blamed Nick Clegg for it. And, there was always the suspicion from the Tories that the Lib Dems were the alibi that Cameron gave to be more moderate than he wanted to be.
One important thing which hasn't been said, this book was written because Ashcroft expected Cameron to have been kicked out of office. And he got that wrong.
But in which, on which universe, in what publishing universe, can you damage your foe with a load of allegations that basically say we've heard from a bloke who said that this might have happened, but we've not been able to verify it, but we're going to put it in the book anyway? And to actually read all of that stuff in the Daily Mail serialisation was just extraordinary. I've never read material in the Daily Mail like it.
Mail wouldn't have printed it if it had
never
come from one of its reporters.
Never
it
in a million years enough. You're quite right.
But don't forget, the other important detail, practical detail, is Ashcroft is rich enough to pick up his own libel bills, so the Daily Mail will one way or another is indemnified against anything that goes wrong with this. It was just, you know, pretty sordid stuff.
It is their right. It is their job, though, occasionally, to add to the gaiety of the nation, and I think they definitely did that.
So normal rules do not apply in terms of, like, fear of the libel laws, maybe. I mean, I guess the Prime Minister is very unlikely to sue anyway. But, Mike, do you think there's something here, though, whether it's the Range Rover parties or whether it's the kind of hanging out with the non-dom or whether it's the kind of bizarre ritual, this kind of mix of things brings back to the front of people's minds at a time when people are about to lose their tax credits and all the rest of it, this idea of Cameron as the kind of young man with the white bow tie? And isn't that in itself a bit damaging?
Well, it might be, except that everybody's known that for 10 years, which he's led the Conservative Party and more or less won 2 elections. They know he's a child of privilege. I was born with 2 silver spoons in my mouth, he told a Tory minister who complained. They may not like it. Unfortunately, he's been the best choice they've had these last few years. We're all surprised after after three meritocratic Tory prime ministers, Heath Thatcher Major, to be stuck with the Etonians. But this book says they saw an opportunity, quite vivid on this, because, of course, Ashcroft is a chippy grammar school boy from Norwich. He's aware of these toffs. He hates them and never misses an opportunity in this book to have somebody, Linton Crosby, the Australian elections guru, using words I can't use on this programme about David Cameron, you know, as a posh tosser, basically.
Well, while the Ashcroft book was, final one, I promise, hogging the limelight in London, George Osborne was on a tour of China, drumming up business, and most controversially, brokering a deal that would see the Chinese government build a new nuclear power station in Somerset. Mike, you've long written that Britain has not fully woken up to the fact of China's economic muscle. Is George Osborne ahead of the game, or is he being played for a fool here? HS2 and the nuclear power station being entrusted in the hands of the Chinese Communist Party?
Again, it's a sort of essay crisis with George Osborne. You don't feel he's thought it through. HS2, the Hinkley Point C nuclear power station. So we're relying on Chinese capital and Chinese money. Now, we've got a lot more Chinese capital coming into Britain than the French and the Germans. The difference is they had trade missions going out there before George Osborne and Dave Cameron knew where it was. And they've got a favourable trade balance with China. We do not. So they're buying up, just as the Qataris are buying up lots of Britain, the Chinese are buying up lots of Britain. And I can't help feeling more uneasy about that than I do about the human rights stuff.
But if we stick, Stephen, to the kind of economy side of it, I mean, it's a sort of mirror image to me of what we had with Gordon Brown and the Labour Party and PFI. You know, the Labour Party had to make its peace with financial markets and engaged in this kind of strange deal, expensive deal, to get hospitals built and so on. And now we've got George Osborne making his peace with Maoist Marxist Leninism in order to get HS2 or Hinkley Point built.
Yeah, it's true. I partially disagree with Mike, I guess, on the idea that Osborne hasn't thought it through. He may not have thought it through well enough, but he has thought it through, which is that he has said there will be a surplus by the end of this parliament. That means that capital investment can't grow as much as it should do, given historically low interest rates. How does he get the private investment to get into his northern powerhouse, into the nuclear stations, into HS2, etc.? The only way he can do it is now by going to China in order to get credit.
We're guaranteeing it, and it'll all go horribly above cost. We know that.
But that'll be down the line. From his point of view, it means that he's got an easier road to clearing the deficit by the end of the parliament. And that's all he cares about at the moment. And this, you know, you can have this off-balance sheet kind of idea of China coming in to buy up our public sector infrastructure. But as long as it doesn't show up on the accounts, that's better than trying to borrow at 3% interest rates. I mean, it's crazy that he's flying 15,000 kilometres across the world when he could just be having a conversation with the Bank of England about how you can get some more R&D in place.
But that's more, isn't that more evidence of them just kind of making it up as they go along? And that's why you worry about this being an Osborne initiative, because you get the sense that George Osborne wouldn't know an ethical consideration if he saw it in the high street. And of course, you know, Osborne will go over there and he will strike the glitziest, best-looking short-term deals that he can. Just as with PFI, your kids and your grandkids will pick up the tab for all of this. But he's not really that bothered about that. And, you know, that is his reputation as a politician. He's just there to get things done. But all of the other considerations are just extraneous matter as far as he's concerned.
Is there a danger that, like, some of these things become so transparently awful that actually people start thinking, oh, maybe Jeremy Corbyn's got a point, it'd be better to just switch on the printing presses from a Tory point of view? Now we've got a Labour leader who is perhaps even too keen to kind of say he's got an alternative up his sleeve rather than kind of tango around and kind of can't quite decide if he's in favour of or against. If Osborne's getting ripped off and Labour stands up and says you're getting ripped off and we just print money instead because that's better, doesn't that mean we're in for a livelier argument here?
Well, it might well be, that might be a good thing for Jeremy Corbyn to run, a good tactic for him to deploy. But, as Stephen was saying here, he could get the money on deals as good here, on terms that are as good here from the banks. And maybe our banks are so discredited that no one actually wants to be seen to be talking to them. But yeah,
you are right. You are right, Tom. I think there is a risk that some of the more perceptive right-wing commentators are saying. You've got people like Fraser Nelson, Tim Montgomery, and so on, attacking Osborne for ignoring China's human rights record, because they fear that there is going to be this massive backlash against capitalism, and they, from their perspective, want to see a much more popular capitalism. And you see with Volkswagen as well this week as well. So this idea that we might have an implosion in support for capitalism is something that those on the centre right who care about these ethical considerations as well are alive to. And from the point of view of someone who is not far right with capitalists by any means, but nonetheless likes the idea that China will, one of its greatest poverty reduction measures is by opening up its economy, that the middle classes are going to press for more political freedoms as a result of having more money and wanting freedom for themselves. That is a good thing. That's why I'm in favour of the trading relationship. But the idea that we should totally disregard all the human rights abuses alongside that is, I think, morally abhorrent.
Very quickly, let's just remember part of this visit was about putting George Osborne in the position of a kind of wannabe prime minister. First of all, Mike, do you think it worked on that narrow political count?
He didn't take Boris Johnson along with him, did he? So he was much better. He had the stage to himself. How can you say? It depends on when Cameron goes, in what shape he goes, and what sort of shape the economy in George Osborne is politically. We love tipping future leaders, but it's a mug's game at this stage. I say, watch that Philip Hammond. I say, he's the John Major of the regime.
OK, let's leave things hanging on that note there. My thanks to Mike, to Stephen, and to Hugh. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.